Namaskaram. My name is Nayad. I'm a tour leader with Explore. Come, follow me for a breakfast you will never forget. Namaste. Because you are going to make an incredible masala dosa under the watchful eye of my mom.
Kya baat hai, mom?
Each home adds their special touches. But not everyone gets to join in a traditional family meal. You will if you explore. For global adventures, search exploreworldwide.com. And don't just travel, explore.
Flexibility is great. That's why there's yoga. Flexibility for your insurance coverage is great too. That's why there's United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, United Healthcare Insurance Plans offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. One of these plans may be right for you if you're, say, between jobs, coming off your parents' plan, turning a side hustle into a full hustle, or even missed open enrollment. Want more flexibility? Find out more about United Healthcare Insurance Plans at uh1.com.
This is The Guardian.
Like, after every election, the Conservatives pretend that the silent majority they speak for is silent and majority, when actually it's clearly a vocal minority.
Hello, lovely people of Pods. Welcome to the show. We've just had our first Guardian Essential poll since the federal election. So, as is our normal routine, I got together with the Director of Essential, Peter Lewis, and the Chief Economist of the Australia Institute, Richard Dennis. This was on a Tuesday night, and we had a good old yak about, a post-mortem of the election, of polling, and of the challenges facing the new Labor government. So, this conversation was recorded on Tuesday evening, and Peter is about to kick us off.
Hey, Merv, what's the mood like down there? Tell us what's going on. So, welcome. I know that you approached Election Day with trepidation, but here we are on the other side.
Yes.
What's going on? How's the vibe?
Well, look, as someone who's covered every transition or change of government since 1996, I can say without a shadow of a doubt that this one is moving at a faster clip than anyone I've previously documented, even though, funnily enough, we're still dragging through the final count of the election more than a week after people cast their votes, or a lot of people cast their votes. You know, it's really extraordinary what's happened in the last week. Obviously, Anthony Albanese has become the Prime Minister, was sworn in with an interim executive, went to Tokyo 5 minutes later, came back. People rolled into Canberra over the last sort of 48 hours. Obviously, there's a new opposition leadership in Peter Dutton and Susan Lee. I was a bit late this evening, and apologies to you all, because Anthony Albanese, after caucus met today, is now currently unveiling his new cabinet and ministry. That's just basically happened in the last 15 minutes or so, and those folks will be sworn in at 9:30 tomorrow. And then by the end of this week, Anthony Albanese will be on the plane again to Jakarta. And he's told us today that Parliament will sit again in the last week of July. So it's moving all over the place. In terms of the ministry, I think it's largely as we expected. It was mooted for some time that Richard Marles, who's the Deputy Labor leader, would end up with Defence, and that's the case. Most people have kind of stayed more or less where they've been in terms of shadow portfolios, but there are some surprises. Tanya Plibersek is the new Environment Minister. I confess I didn't see that one coming. Also, Claire O'Neill, who is a Victorian right-winger, has been given the Home Affairs portfolio, which is obviously a big challenge and a big responsibility and a big step up for her, but she's an incredibly bright.
In terms of the sense of the government, yes. I know that Albo has tried to take the heat out, even of the partisan attacks, that we're not going to call Peter Dutton any names under his watch. Does it feel different there, or does it just, is it just like a pain?
No, it does. It does. It's extraordinary I don't know, was it Keating who said change the government, change the country? And certainly we've got the beginning of a new tempo and tone in Canberra. It's very different, obviously, to the previous government, early days, of course, but it is very different. I think even though Anthony Albanese didn't have the greatest election campaign, he wasn't always confident and he didn't always kind of master the daily hustings vaudeville, I think he's looking incredibly confident since they've all been back. And in this theatre of parliament and government, this is very, very familiar territory to Anthony Albanese. This is not, you know, something that he's never experienced before. He's looking very confident. He's asserting his confidence. He is, as you say, Pete, sort of, you know, trying to presage a new tone in the way politics is conducted. He's sort of gesturing at the new parliament, which has a record number of crossbenchers in the lower house, in terms of, you know, we've got to think about doing politics differently. You know, this kind of rhetoric, I think it'll be very interesting to see whether or not, sorry, I just haven't turned my emails off. If you're all getting
it's all right, you're probably getting a few pings right now.
Yeah, it's quite a lot of.
Where's the copy from Newsdesk?
Pretty much. But anyway, let's just move that away for a moment so I can focus here. So, yeah, look, he's gesturing in the direction of this new parliament and the new dynamics of the parliament. I think it'll be very interesting whether or not Labor appoints a speaker from the crossbench. The development today was that Labor will now govern with 77 seats. Labor declared Gilmore in its column, and so that pushes them to 77. They could then get a speaker from within their own ranks and still command a majority on the floor of the House of Reps. It's been an open question, certainly around the government, about whether or not they'll appoint a speaker from the crossbench, which would be very interesting if that's what they did. So, you know, look, it's a long way to go. Obviously, Parliament's not even back yet. But, yes, I think there is a very different tone. And if you watched every minute of the hustings and you thought, you know, Anthony Albanese doesn't look that confident, I can say that he looks entirely confident now.
Yeah. Like he's got through his initiation rite and now he is the man.
Well, it's sort of like it's his theatre, I think, whereas that sort of the campaign was not his theatre. That's the first time he's done a campaign, obviously. Well, obviously not his first political campaign was when he was 12, but the first, obviously, as the Labor leader and putative Prime Minister. And I think he will have learned a lot about the dynamics of campaigning that he didn't know prior to sort of going through the 2022 exercise. But look, Parliament and government, the institutions of Canberra, how this runs, how the Labor Party runs as an institution and governs, he's entirely fluent in that. And I think he's sort of looked delighted really to be back in a theatre where he feels he has the lie of the land and a certain degree of mastery.
Now, I'm going to exercise stand-in MC privileges because this is pole position. We're here to look at the polling. Richard, I know that this time 3 years ago, there was, I guess, in my industry of polling, a degree of self-flagellation going on because we're on the extremes of margin of error. So I thought it was useful to maybe, before we get too deeply into this, open the kimono and tell you how we went this time with the Essential Report at least. So I'm going to do that very inelegant sharing of the screen and just show you what we came up with. Here we go. Here's our poll position put together by the fantastic Rob Lever. Now, we were a little bit thin on the primary vote. If you look at this, we're down on both major parties, where I do take some comfort, the gap's about the same. So we're a little bit fat on the major parties, a little bit skinny on the Greens, sorry, Greens, a little bit skinny on the Independents. We don't quite have an explanation of all that, but what we will do over the next month is really interrogate those findings and make sure that we have our weightings right. There are some theories floating around that, you know, for instance, there are strategic Labor voters that pushed the Labor primary vote down because they lived in Teal seats and they wanted to see the Teals elected and all those Teal supporters, good on you. I saw it coming. Most people didn't. But it does say to me that this poll is probably still a little bit overrepresentative of the major parties, and we're going to look at what's going on there and whether it's the nature of the sample, whether it's the nature of the weighting. But the one I do want to show everyone is this, because I reckon this ain't bad. So in terms of the 2PP, where Essential said, you know, 51-49, and it came out 51-49. Richard?
I think the polls were quite accurate this time. The polls accurately predicted the swing to the Teals. Most people kind of wanted to tell themselves the polls were wrong when it came to those independents. Most people wanted to tell themselves that, oh, maybe one or two of them would win, but they couldn't all win. The polls said they could all win, which didn't make it inevitable, but, you know, what the polls said happened. And majority Labor government was predicted by the polls, and that's what's come in. So, yeah, I don't think that we can ever – a poll is not an election, and if they were, we could save ourselves a lot of time and a lot of money in 3 years.
Yeah.
But, yeah, look, the polls were quite wrong 3 years ago. But in some sense, I think that there was so much seat polling this time. And again, everyone's a bit nervous about seat polling, but 3 years ago, perhaps there wasn't enough. There was just that national poll. And let's never forget that at the last election, the 2019 election, there were big swings to Labor in those safe Liberal seats. There were really a lot of votes moved, but no seats moved. And that actually set up what just happened with the Teals, with the independents winning all those seats. It was in those same seats where a lot of Liberal voters shifted last time, which did affect the polls, but didn't affect the seats that changed hands.
Yeah, look, I think we did a good job of taking the polls out of the competition, and by that I mean polling should always be part of the noise behind the election, not the scoreboard. And I think that I think. Partly once bitten, twice shy, like everyone was a bit suspicious of the polls, but we were very conscious, for instance, to keep the don't knows in there and to say, we're not telling you what's going to happen. We're just trying to give you a bit of an indication of what's happening now. I think the other thing is that it's, and maybe this is a broader discussion when Murph gets here, but it feels to me that this may be, well, it 2019 might have been the last real two-party election where two-party preferred is even relevant, because so many seats, and if you watch individual seats moving in three-corner contests, the two-party preferred is shifting green-blue, red-blue, red-green, particularly in that seat of McNamara. So if we are moving towards more of a multi-party system where there are more voices and more players, then again, we're going to have to adapt the way that we take the temperature of the political system.
Oh, absolutely. And I think, well, A, that will be good. That'll be better for democracy. But B, in terms of the two-party preferred and in terms of just looking at elections as a horse race between two major parties, look, you know, as someone that worked for the Democrats 20 years ago and worked for the Greens 15 years ago, it's always been hard for independents and minor parties to rate a mention in a lot of national analysis. I do hope those days are behind us. But also, I mean, think about the dynamics in the lead up to the next election. You know, the Liberals will spend a year ripping into themselves as loudly as they'll try and rip into Labor. But let's just kind of put them aside for a while because we can. But in 2 years' time, when we start to think about what's going to happen to the election, real issues like, so will the Liberal Party pursue trying to win back those once heartland seats or not, won't just have kind of horse race connotations. Strategic decisions like whether to abandon that former heartland or whether to try and win it back is going to have a huge impact on the nature and the shape of the policy debates that we have, because the issues the Liberals will have to focus on to win back the broken heartland are going to be quite different from, you know, if the Liberals are still taking advice from Tony Abbott and they're going to chase out of suburban seats off Labor. So if we're going to have a more nuanced picture of the whole electoral map, and in turn, issues polling and seat by seat polling I think is going to play an even more important role.
You know, the other one that I don't know if people here picked up was that the guys at YouGov working with News Poll ran a very different model, the MRP, which was effectively a big data exercise. So they did a survey of 11,000 Australians and then broke that into census, quite granular census segments, then matched them against electorates and then did a big, brave prediction that the election would end up with 80 seats Labor. They were a little bit fat on that as well, but it was interesting, particularly in the Labor pickups. They were pretty right. They missed a number of the Teal pickups. But I thought it's great when you get new methodologies coming into the system, and that was really just using data rather than polling, to be honest with you. I'm still not sure. A lot of those single seats, they were kind of right, but there are quite a few that were a bit skittish as well. We did ask a few questions this week. I'll just run through them quickly and get both you two to reflect on it, if you will, and then we will go to questions. And there's a heap of questions in the chat. What is interesting on this, and if you are listening at home on the Guardian Pod, you need to go to essentialreport.com.au. There is broad support for the Labor agenda. If you look at all these issues, there is either strong or somewhat support and very low opposition, but also encouraging manufacturing, improving the status of women in the workplace, support an increase to the minimum wage, federal ICAC, renewables, universal access to early learning and a voice. There's a bit of texture in terms of some of those, but what stood out to me in those was the primacy of the economic pieces and the pieces that are not so much what you'd call performative. None of it's performative, but more the stuff that is hard yards economics, like raising wages and building stuff here, is the stuff that people really want to see. And if I look at where the election map has ended up, Labor has held the Hunter, they've held the Central Coast, they've held provincial regions like the Illawarra, Gilmore, down into Geelong. This seems to me to be really important for the long-term Labor government. There is one constituency which is locking in the progressive vote and not fracturing that. But this is where the next election will be fought around building economic opportunity on the fringe of the city and the regions as the economy faces global pressures. Is that right, wrong, rubbish? Catherine, Richard, go me.
No, I think you're right. I think that while Labor will have a small but absolute majority in the parliament, the combination of that with the number of Greens who've, you know, won seats from Labor and the coalition now, and the independents, while Labor has a small majority, there's a super majority of parliamentarians that support, as you show in the slide, what the public wants. And it's weird because, well, it's weird, there is an explanation, of course, but there's been a structural disconnect in Australia for quite some time between what an overwhelming majority of Australians wanted and what a majority of Parliament would go along with. And same-sex marriage kind of broke that, and it was brutal and traumatic for many of those involved, but it really sort of showed that just because you could use parliamentary numbers to stop change, it didn't stop the demand for change outside of Parliament. And now we're seeing that wash through with the coalition, the Liberals, losing their literally heartland seats. And I've got a piece in the Monthly out, I think it's out today, saying, you know, if you lose your heartland, do you still have a heart? Like, what does it mean when a party loses its heartland? But it's gone, and it's been replaced with independents who aren't going to agree with Labor and everything and aren't going to agree with the Greens and everything. But if we kind of flip it on its head and say, right, there's a super majority of people in Parliament that want climate action, there's a super majority of people that want a federal ICAC, there's a super majority that want to see all sorts of things, including an Indigenous voice to Parliament. If Albanese, who used to be leader of government business in the House, he knows about Parliament, if he's actually willing to, he's not going to need to necessarily negotiate with any of those people in the lower house. He will need the Greens in the upper house. But if he combines the issues that Labor care about with the issues that there's a super majority in Parliament about, that the issues that he can get through the Senate, then I think the Liberals and the Nationals are going to look pretty irrelevant and pretty last century, quite frankly, if everybody plays to their strengths. Now, let's not underestimate the potential for log jams amongst those that agree with each other, but I reckon there's plenty of opportunities here to pass a lot of ledge that will get the public on side and really show how out of touch and how, frankly, irrelevant the Tony Abbott and Scott Morrison view of the Liberal Party's been.
Yeah, Catherine, it feels like we've not just witnessed a change of government, but maybe a change of political fault lines. On these numbers, the Morrison's government position on most of these things is not where the debate is at. It's kind of like they're over there in Tennant Creek with, you know, the Sky After Dark crew.
And
it's not a non-agenda either. There's a bit there.
Yeah. Oh well, that's true. And you know, as Richard says, and you're getting at, there is this new parliament, the 47th, it will be a progressive parliament. And what occurred in the election campaign was a group, I suppose, that have sort of been long mooted as potentially decoupling from the Liberal Party on social issues, climate change, whatever else. Like we've been talking about this, Pete, you and I, for a long, long time. This sort of group of progressive Liberal voter who Labor has been through God knows how many election cycles, imagining is going to sort of decouple and vote Labor
or Green,
right? I mean that hasn't happened, but it did in 22. Part of it was the disruption of having for Liberals having someone to vote for Liberals who can't vote Labor, tribal Liberals who can't vote Labor, then obviously having an independent was an important sort of step along that road of decoupling, I guess, right? So they could vote for independence. I think a lot of Labor people also voted strategically for independence if they were in those electorates, and that sort of got them across the line. I agree that there is, that there is this sort of realignment. Well, I mean, this election is certainly the biggest electoral realignment since the Democrats, on the centre-right, I mean. Biggest realignment since the Democrats were formed in the late 70s.
They didn't change government. They were a noise. I reckon it's the biggest realignment since the split.
Well, it's sort of maybe. I think we've got to see how this plays out, right? There's the big thing that's happened is that this demographic, this cohort, who have long been rumoured to be consciously uncoupling from the Liberal Party, actually did in this election campaign. It obviously, then that's a realignment yet to be banked. Obviously, people who did not vote Liberal in this election campaign have got to basically be comfortable, I suppose, with their alternate choice, right? Be that the Greens in some seats in Brisbane, or be that the new group of teal independents. But also we shouldn't forget that that a number of Liberal seats in the city fell as well. Reid, Higgins, and in those seats, Liberals voted Labor. So, there was obviously it's a big shift, this result. It's a lot to get your head around, particularly if you were like me and not really thinking that this would happen until I saw it. There's quite a lot to unpick here.
Yeah.
And, yeah, look, it's certainly, as electoral realignments go, it's big. Mm-hmm. But I think we've still got to see how it's proved up over the next 3 years to see whether or not Australians are going to, I suppose, decouple from their preferred major party of choice in this election cycle, the Liberal Party, whether that's a sort of transient protest vote or whether it is a structural shift. I think we've got to just wait and see on that front.
I banged on about this for a number of months, saying that government only changes in a wave and Labor wins big or not at all. And I think what's interesting is that Labor hasn't picked up the 20 seats that a new incoming government normally does, but the Libs have basically lost 20. So yeah. There was a massive outgoing. The tide totally went out on the Libs, but rather than just Labor surfing it in, there are a whole lot of other people that have surfed that into shore.
But I do think, though, Pete, that's absolutely right. And now there's this sort of like, you know, I think in international affairs there's this concept called the buffer state, right? And in terms of now the independents, the larger crossbench is a buffer state, right? But I do think, though, that looking at that, I suppose, you know, Labor didn't absolutely kick this into touch. Labor didn't absolutely kind of surf along on a big progressive victory, which is what we're used to in campaigns when Labor wins from opposition. I do think, though, it's sort of like we need to understand how difficult this campaign was, I think, for the Labor Party to hold its traditional blue-collar territories, as it did, you know, the Hunter seats around there, regional seats. They held those territories as well as kind of picking up ground in sort of more progressive urban contests as well. That is an incredibly hard thing to do in an age of atomization and in an age of tribalism, to put together, literally piece together a coalition of interests, where and sometimes the interests of individuals are viewed as being diametrically opposed, right? I do think that's a sort of undervalued element of this election win for Labor, is that somehow they managed to keep this sort of coalition between traditional supporters and newer progressives.
And in a way, these numbers show why, because the issues they ran on had that broad support. They'd just been distorted by the binary nature of the two-party state, and that's kind of broken up, yeah?
Pete, just quickly on that, I think you're spot on, but let's not underestimate that at the next election, rather than, like, usually at an election, everyone's going after the government, but at the next election, there'll be independents looking at how close the Liberals are in Deakin, looking at how close to losing Paul Fletcher was in Bradfield. And it's not obvious that even in 3 years' time, the Liberals will be the ones defining the seats where they will put their resources. So, yeah, this... having looked for 20 years at polling and why people don't vote for independents and why they don't vote for minor parties, there's two reasons that come out in every focus group and every poll, and that is don't want to waste my vote, or, not quite sure what they stand for. Now we have independents and the Greens winning seats left, right and centre. They're going to be front and centre for another 3 years. And people now know that it's not a wasted vote. So I think there's more Libs that'll be worried, particularly Michael Sukkar and former communications minister who suffered a 15% swing, Paul Fletcher.
Well, I feel like I'm about to lose my job as host. Can I just quickly go through these slides, then we'll go to questions? And this slide shows there is majority support now for Uluru statement, including an Indigenous voice in Parliament, but it's tight, 53, but that's the first time it's been above 53. So I might just quickly go through these and then get you guys to give an overview. So voice is one thing that we need to sort of think through how that's going to play out and what that does to this alliance. On the other side, there is this, we asked, at your request, I might add, Catherine, whether people thought Labor's target on 2030 was enough or not enough. And you can see there, it's pretty tight there, 41-35, 24% unsure. That's a potential left flank battle line. And the other ones that are just kind of nice for people to know is that we actually do like the idea that there are more views being represented in Parliament, 2-1, and we think democracy is working better. So that's also good, 47% satisfied with democracy, up from 35. And that wasn't right after the 2019 election where none of us were satisfied in democracy. That was in 2017 when we thought that you know, the tide was going out on the government. So I'm going to stop the slides there. But I guess there you've got voice, climate and democracy. I don't know if you want to sort of weave a hot take into that, Catherine, for me.
Well, maybe a tepid take. No, joking, sorry. Look, I do think they're really interesting issues to kind of group together. I think, and we can sort of look at it just quickly through the prism of the new Liberal leadership. Obviously, after an election result like the ones the Liberal Party had last Saturday night, you would think that the Liberal Party would be accepting that there is now a supermajority in favour of climate action. But Peter Dutton is showing no signs of putting down the cudgels, at least on medium-term action. Interestingly, though, in terms of the voice, where bipartisan support will actually be quite important to running a successful referendum. Peter Dutton, the guy who walked out on the apology to the Stolen Generations in 2008, did say yesterday, well, he didn't say yes, but he didn't say no either. He said, I just want to think this through. I understand I did the wrong thing in 2008. You know, we've got to sort of manage this through our processes and work out where we want to go with this, which is a pretty big deal coming from him, actually, where he's lined up on some of these debates. I think it's extremely difficult for Peter Dutton to basically get agreement in the coalition for a constitutionally enshrined voice to Parliament. I think that will be extremely difficult because in his faction, the right faction of the Liberal Party, there's a lot of sort of, it's a ridiculous phrase in the Australian context to say constitutional originalists. This makes no sense at all in our democracy, but it's a similar disposition, right? Some people just don't want the framework added to, and there are a number of them in the Liberal Party, and that's what made it extremely difficult for Ken Wyatt to try and progress this agenda. And, of course, Scott Morrison famously came out, said to Ken Wyatt, yes, let's do it, then discovered that basically he'd get rolled in the party room if it was yes, let's do it. Look, it'll be difficult for Dutton, but if he decides he wants to do it, well, he's got the cachet on the right, maybe he can carry his own people. So that's a bit of a watch this space, I think.
Richard, on the climate issue, there is probably two competing arguments going on, depending what side of the green-red divide you sit. I think Labor's position is let's just lock in the mandate we have, and the Greens are pretty set in saying we need to be more ambitious. How do you see that playing out?
Oh, look, I think that, again, you know, there's a super majority that says let's do more. How will parliamentary dynamics either reflect what's happened outside Parliament, which is get on and do stuff, or get in the way of it?
Those findings didn't say do more. That was kind of split, wasn't it? Yeah. It was pretty...
But obviously the Greens are going to say we were elected on a mandate to do more. The Teal candidates are going to say they were elected on a mandate to do more. Everyone's going to rightly say that 43 is an arbitrary number. You know, even the Business Council wants 50. But you can see why a newly elected Labor government's going to start with, this is what we promised to do, this is what we're going to do. You know, I think we'll see a debate about quality, not quantity. 43%, all right, what's the role of dodgy offsets? What's the role of fossil fuel subsidies? What about building new coal mines? What about new gas? Like
there's lots of debates within the 43 is what you're saying.
I would say above the 43. I mean, I'm not Robinson Crusoe on this, but, you know, as someone that, as an economist interested in climate policy for 20 years, I couldn't tell you the number of times we've changed the base year and the percentage number that we're willing to die in a ditch over. All right, the targets aren't meaningless, but they aren't everything. But they take, because they're concrete, because they're a number, you know, there's something that you either support or oppose. And I think that if the Greens are smart and the Independents are smart, and I think they are, they're going to find a way to turn it into 43 plus. It'll be, all right, you can have your target, but you've got to increase the integrity of what the hell that means. And we're not going to let some farmers promise to not chop down an extra tree or whatever in order to get to your target. And I think that you'll see the fight about no new coal, no new gas coming over the top of 43, saying, great, you've passed that target, but the real problem we face is X and Y and Z. So I think there will be a willing debate about the target. I can understand why Labor will want to stick with what they took to the campaign, but I think the climate debate, and domestically and internationally, will overwhelm this. I mean, the Pacific Island states have all made it clear that they want Australia to stop building new coal mines. Does that make building new coal mines a plaything of the Greens or a centrepiece of our national security? You know, we need to kind of open up our field of vision and see that things like 43 versus 30, you know, are not the be-all and end-all when it comes to climate debate.
Hey, Catherine, I think you and I had kind of similar takes on this, which is part of the story of this government is going to be learning from the mistakes of the Rudd-Gillard era. I've kind of chanced my arm running a tortured metaphor on second marriages in your August publication today. But I am interested in the echoes of what went wrong managing climate last time and whether that is relevant today and how you see that playing out over the next months.
Yeah, well, look, it'll be a really defining debate in this parliament for sure. I think Anthony Albanese has thought a lot about the Rudd-Gillard period, what went wrong and how you might try and prevent those mistakes from repeating. But he's not a magician at the end of the day. He's just a prime minister. But I do think he has thought a lot about this. And part of his thinking about not repeating the Rudd-Gillard thing is having a concrete agenda that's able to be implemented in one term of government so you don't get into the dreadful Rudd scenario, which was that climate change is the great moral challenge of our time. But when you run aground with your agenda, then you're seen in the public space to backtrack and walk off it. I think that's where sort of 43% in the architecture that they have put to voters at this election sort of represents this idea about what can we do, what is doable, and doesn't sort of get us into that dreadful bind that we found ourselves in the Rudd-Gillard period, which was then, you know, basically sort of accelerated the weaponisation of climate action for a decade.
Do you think the Libs and the Nats still see benefit in weaponising it, or is that the other change?
This is the thing about Peter Dutton that's been interesting. I would have thought that he would sue for peace, that he would come in on 2030 with a signal that this is doable or this is something that we can get our heads around. I think it's very obvious from Peter Dutton's opening comments in the leadership that he thinks that climate change, once the Labor Party gets into actual mechanisms and structures in order to deliver it, will sort of basically default to the turgid cost of living argument that the Liberals have used basically to sort of work against climate action for a decade. That's clearly Dutton's working supposition. Energy prices are going to go up, cost of living is going to go up. I think he is sort of limbering up basically to paint a picture to voters that if you act too preemptorily in the medium term, it's basically a world of pain for consumers. That's where he's going with it. So, I totally agree with you and Richard that there is this supermajority for climate action, but it's not occurring in a vacuum. It's occurring against a major party opponent, which, you know, has been very good at weaponising this issue for 10 years. It is the defining debate of this parliament, but it's quite complicated for Albanese to manage, and I think that's, you know, if we see...
Potentially a bit of friction on the left won't be terrible either.
Well, not necessarily, but it's sort of, it depends. Like, I'm very hopeful that, that, you know, I was disappointed with Dutton's positioning yesterday. He had a form of words on the Integrity Commission. He's going to basically push that through. He pushed Susan Lee out there to basically do the apologia to women. I know you didn't vote for us. I know you hate us, but, you know, we're listening to you. And I thought, okay, maybe he'll sue for peace on climate, but he did not. So that is a dynamic that, Albanese and others is going to have to manage in this parliament.
So look, at 11 minutes to the hour, I'm getting to some questions from the floor. Alastair McCulloch asks Catherine, is this the first election that Murdoch hasn't been on the winning side? If so, what implications do you draw?
I don't think Murdoch was on the winning side in 2007 either, although it was mixed, right?
The Telegraph put down the pom bombs, to quote David Pemberthy.
No, that is true. Look, I think every election I've covered, every single one, it's very difficult because, you know, the sort of the default of the Murdoch media is to be hostile to Labor governments. It's just a question of whether the hostile is sort of muted, or the hostility, I should say, is muted, or whether it's on full, you know, dialed up to 11. Mm-hmm. Look, I will also wouldn't rush to judgment. There's a lot sort of being said in slightly triumphalist sort of tones that are, look, you know, the mainstream media in general and the Murdoch press specifically, this election result shows they have no influence anymore. Look, maybe it does. But again, I think, you know, it's still a big issue. It's still a big issue. And it's not only the Murdoch press. There are a lot of institutional interests in Australia that are hostile to progressive governments, always been thus, ever will be thus. And in terms of influence, well, look, yes, the mainstream media in general, all of us, we're not as influential as we were 20 years ago pre-internet. That's absolutely right. But I wouldn't say that the sort of hostility that accompanied Albanese, largely from the Murdoch media, played no role in the election. I think that would be with due respect, I think that would be quite
annoying. There is an argument with a fair run, Labor would have won a bigger majority.
Well, these things are quite hard to measure. And I wouldn't, you know, I would not reach some sort of conclusion that you know, this ipso facto Labor wins election means that the concentration of centre right, highly polarising, at times highly partisan media plays no role in shaping public consciousness. I think there is still a contribution there.
Just quickly, Pete, I mean, the Courier Mail raged against Anastasia Palaszczuk to no effect for three elections in a row. The Herald Sun thinks that, you know, Daniel Andrews should have lost the last election that he won in a landslide. I think the Murdoch press is much better at shifting debates than it is about shifting the votes. It draws enormous attention to what it wants to put on the front page. The ABC then follows it. So I think the Murdoch press plays a very important role in setting the agenda of what we're allowed to talk sensibly about in Australia, but it clearly doesn't shift votes in the way that perhaps people fear it does.
Yeah, one of the ironies was that its all-out attack on the Teals merely raised its name recognition, which, if you talk to them, was actually the one challenge that they needed to meet to get over the finish line.
It's a mixed bag. From that perspective, it's definitely a mixed bag. Certainly that elevation of name recognition was extremely helpful to the Teals. But it's just, look, I think it's... you know, to say that the Murdoch media had no impact on this campaign, I don't think that's true.
Should we do a couple more questions? I'll quickly go. Sue Masters asks, what about the two elections coming up, same tactics or new ones? Like, does this election tell us anything about what's going to come up over the next 12 months?
In state elections? Or?
Yeah. Like, we've got Victoria and New South Wales following pretty quickly, right?
Well, look, I think just quickly, I think basically the sort of that Climate 200 community independence model for campaigning has now been proven up, right? It seems likely that that model will be taken into state contests. But also, I think we need to bear in mind as concerned citizens in a democracy that once a model is proven up, it can be utilised in a number of different ways. So while you know, obviously this created a bridge for Liberal Party voters to decouple from the Liberal Party and vote for candidates that Liberal voters felt they could vote for. There's a million ways.
Could you set up a pack and run brown independents that take out Labor heartland? Yeah. Like, you know.
This is the thing about innovations in political contests. Once you prove up a model, it can be utilised in a bunch of different ways. Obviously, issues have to be salient. I mean, that's the point. Like, obviously, independents could not have won the number of seats that they did on a platform that was meaningless to voters, because then obviously no one would vote for them. So there needs to be conditions conducive to sort of success for your proven up alternative model. But I do think we need to bear that in mind, that we have in this election cycle demonstrated, there's a proven up model now that can be deployed against either of the major parties on a range of issues.
Yeah, and interesting, the Teals didn't go any Labor seats this time. I think the dynamic on the progressive side will change markedly if they do.
Yeah. Well, it's interesting to sort of think. I mean, I don't see that's an immediate proposition that any of us are countenancing, but I'm just stating an obvious fact, right? Like, we've had Clive Palmer, a very high wealth individual, try and basically sort of spend huge amounts of money in order to get political representation over a couple of election cycles. That model has not been proven up as a success, but the independence model in this election campaign has been proven up as a success. It'll be interesting to see who learns from it and who tries to sort of, reconfigure it and make it work in a different style of campaign. And also just, I think the Labor Party acknowledges that the Greens' ground game in Brisbane, in metropolitan Brisbane, just killed them in terms of efficiency and efficacy. And I think it'll be interesting to see, both major parties looking at that, learning from it, and trying to implement it in the contests that are coming up.
Yeah, I'm more upbeat than that. I mean, a couple of things. One, Labor, they're never going to thank the Greens for this, but Labor kind of match fit in having to cover their left flank while appealing to the middle, because they've actually had that fight with the Greens for 20 years, and losing Melbourne, Lindsay Tanner's old seat, hurt, and Labor have been alive to that threat for a long time. The Libs haven't been. So I think the Teals will continue to go after. I'm not saying they won't go after a Labor, an independent won't go after a Labor seat, but they've got to kind of, you have a three-way race with the Greens there. It's open terrain in the Liberal seats. And also, let's not forget, remember when Corey Bernardi was going to set up the Conservative version of GetUp and about 14 people joined? Like, after every election, the Conservatives pretend that the silent majority they speak for is silent and majority, when actually it's clearly a vocal minority.
That's
terrific, yeah.
No, but as Catherine said, you actually need the salience of the issues that motivate people. And these people are just angry and bitter, and whenever they say, and we're going to rise up and we're going to bring everyone with us, no one comes. So, yeah, they could use the model, but history says that, there's 1,000 people watching our webinar tonight. The IPA's got a lot more money. I guarantee there's not 1,000 people watching a webinar of theirs tonight. So, Catherine's right. The model can be deployed by anyone, but the model only works when there's a lot of people who genuinely care and believe.
Yeah,
totally. And I don't think that's there.
That's all for today. Thank you so much for listening and for turning up, as people do in vast numbers, to a poll position, which is hosted by the Australia Institute. If you didn't watch the video version of this and you've only heard the audio version of it, please have a look at the slides on the Essential Media website. That sort of takes you through the various poll metrics that Peter flags during the conversation. This episode was produced by Miles Martignoni.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more.
Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.